Hello and welcome to Pets Plus Us, a weekly program of information and stories about the companions in our lives, our pets. I'm Mary DeFranco, your host for Pets Plus Us. Coming up this half hour, where to get your new rabbit, horse care guidelines, introducing your pets to your newborn, and the history of guide dogs. We'll start with something from the Humane Society of the United States. Where to get your new rabbit? Should you get the bunny of your dreams from a shelter, rescue group, or a breeder? Most rabbits are surrendered to shelters because of people problems, not issues with the health or behavior of the bunny. So, you've decided to get a rabbit. You've learned what it takes to provide great care and an appropriate diet. You've bunny-proofed your house. You've found a great rabbit veterinarian. And you're ready to give one or two or more special bunnies the attention and exercise they need every day. But you've got one more thing to take care of. Choose where you'll get your new pet. You don't want to buy a bunny from a pet store because most of the rabbits come from mass breeding facilities that can be like puppy mills. So, what are your options? Animal shelters and rescue groups. When you're ready to adopt, your local shelter or rabbit rescue group should be your first stop. If they don't have the right rabbit for you now, ask to be put on a waiting list. To locate a rescue group that specializes in rabbits, contact your local animal shelter or search online through the House Rabbit Society. After cats and dogs, rabbits are the species most often surrendered to animal shelters. The majority of rabbits lose their homes because of people reasons, such as a move or the owner's inability or unwillingness to care for the animal, not because the rabbit has behavioral or health problems. In addition to shelters, there are numerous private rabbit adoption agencies that are run by people with in-depth knowledge of rabbits. Most groups depend on volunteers who provide foster care for homeless rabbits until they can find them a home. Many rabbit rescue groups partner with local animal shelters, helping to place bunnies through their foster care networks. When you contact a rescue group, be sure to find out as much as you can about the organization, how it cares for animals, how it decides which animals are adoptable, and what other adoption and post-adoption services are available. There are advantages to adopting a rabbit. Staff and volunteers at well-run shelters or rescue groups work hard to keep the bunnies socialized and healthy. Their hands-on experience with the rabbits will enable them to help you choose the right bunny for you. And unlike the teenage part-timers at your local pet store, the people at your local shelter and rescue group can provide detailed information on bunny care and behavior and answer questions you may have after adoption. Adoption fees vary, but the package may include a certificate for a free vet visit or a reduced cost spay or neuter surgery if your bunny isn't already sterilized. It's easy to find an adoptable rabbit. To find your local animal shelter, search online or visit petfinder.com. To locate a rescue group that specializes in rabbits, contact your local animal shelter or search online through the House Rabbit Society. Buying from a breeder. If you looked at all the local animal shelters in a rabbit rescue group and still haven't found the one and you just can't wait to bring home your new rabbit, you may be wondering how to identify and locate a reputable breeder. Good breeders are not in the business just to make money. They don't sell their rabbits to the first person who shows up with cash in hand. A good breeder is one who is personally involved in each and every sale. He will never sell through a pet store or any other third party that doesn't allow him to meet the prospective family and make sure it's a good match for his rabbit. Too often, unsuspecting customers buy animals from so-called backyard breeders, people who breed their pets to make a little money on the side. They're not knowledgeable about genetics and good breeding practices, and the result is rabbits with health or temperament problems that may not be discovered until years later. Recommendations can point you toward a good breeder. You can find reputable breeders by asking for referrals from your veterinarian or trusted friends, by contacting local breed clubs, or by visiting rabbit shows. Always visit the breeder before you buy. Don't buy a rabbit without personally visiting where he or she was born and raised. Take the time now to find the right breeder, and you'll thank yourself for the rest of your rabbit's life. While you're visiting, look for these basics. The rabbits should appear happy and healthy. The breeder's home and the rabbit's area should be clean, well-maintained, and well-lit. The breeder should have a strong relationship with a local veterinarian and should provide records and references about his rabbit's care. The breeder should be able to explain common genetic problems. He or she should be able to provide references from other families who have purchased rabbits from him or her, should be willing to serve as a resource and answer questions for the rest of the rabbit's life. The breeder should be involved with local, state, and national breed clubs. And the breeder should provide a written contract with a health guarantee and encourage you to read and understand the contract fully before signing. This contract should not require you to visit a certain veterinarian. The breeder should be just as tough on you as you are with her. She should ask questions about your experiences with other rabbits and other pets, and she should ask for a veterinary reference. To locate a rescue group that specializes in rabbits, contact your local animal shelter or online through the House Rabbit Society. Next, horse care guidelines from the Humane Society of the United States. Be responsible and reap the rewards. Sharing your life with a horse can be a rewarding experience, but it includes the responsibility of caring for your equine companion for life. Your horse depends on your love, care, and commitment. You'll show your love through grooming, petting, riding, and the occasional treat. You must also show your commitment by providing for her needs 365 days a year, in good weather and bad. Good care. With good care, your horse can live 35 years or more. Here are some general horse care considerations. First, routine horse care is a significant and ongoing expense. The purchase price of a horse is often much less than the cost of maintaining a horse for a year. Make sure you are realistic about your ability to afford quality care before you acquire an equine companion. Next, horses need a regular supply of food and water. In most cases, they need to have hay or pasture throughout the day, with additional grain feedings twice a day. An average-sized horse will eat about 20 pounds of food a day and drink at least 8 gallons of water because their stomachs are relatively small and their digestive system surprisingly delicate. Horses need to nibble or graze throughout the day rather than have one or two meals a day. Horses need hoof maintenance. Plan to hire a farrier or a blacksmith every 6 to 8 weeks for routine hoof trimming or shoeing. Horses need veterinary care. At least once a year, your horse will need to be vaccinated against tetanus and other diseases. The veterinarian will also provide routine dental care. Keep in mind that medical emergencies, which are always an unfortunate possibility, can cost several thousands of dollars to treat. Be aware of parasites. Since horses are constantly exposed to intestinal worms from the ground they graze on, they must be on an anti-parasite regimen as prescribed by your equine practitioner. Carrying a heavy burden of worms can cause serious illness or death in equines, so regular and timely treatment is crucial to your horse's health. Don't forget about shelter. Horses need constant access to a dry, safe, comfortable shelter to protect them from rain, wind, and snow. In warm and sunny weather, the shelter you supply will provide your companion with much-needed shade and relief from biting insects. At a minimum, you should have a well-constructed, three-sided shed into which your horse can retreat at all times. You will need to remove manure from the stall and shelter every day. And horses need exercise. To supplement the exercise your horse will get when you ride him, he should have a paddock or pasture in which to relax and stroll. No horse should spend all day confined in a stall. except on a veterinarian's recommendation. The pasture should be bordered by safe, sturdy fencing that will keep the horse safe and secure. Barbed wire is not an acceptable fencing material. It has been the cause of many serious injuries. More tips and information can be found in the book, The Humane Society of the United States Complete Guide to Horse Care, which you can find on their website at humanesociety.org. Next, here's a history of guide dogs written by Tori Holmes for BarkPost.com. Guide dogs have been leading the way since the days of ancient Rome. The idea of using dogs as guides for the blind may seem like a modern idea, but the history of guide dogs stretches as far back as the first century AD. While the formalized training of dogs to lead the blind wasn't until the late 1700s, a mural found in the buried ruins of Roman Herculaneum and other records from Asia and Europe up to the Middle Ages suggests that this practice began much earlier. The formal training of dogs to lead the blind really took hold in Europe around the 1780s, beginning at Le Convent Hospital for the Blind in Paris and slowly making its way east to Austria. In 1819, Johann Wilhelm Klein, the founder of the Institute for the Education of the Blind in Vienna, made significant progress in the field when he included the idea of guide dogs in his book on education for the blind. He even went so far as to include details about his method for training these dogs. These early events were important in shaping the story of the modern guide dog, which began during the First World War. The use of poison gas on the front lines meant that many soldiers returned home from war blinded. After seeing how his own dog began looking after his blind patients, a German doctor by the name of Gerhard Stalling began teaching groups of dogs the skills necessary to guide these blinded veterans. Stalling's work led him to open the world's first guide dog school in Oldenburg, Germany, in August 1916. The work that Dr. Stalling was doing with these dogs was well received, and the school grew, eventually opening branches across Germany. Collectively, the different branches were able to train up to 600 dogs each year. These numbers allowed them to provide dogs not only to the veterans who inspired the movement, but also to the blind across the world. Unfortunately, trained dogs in these numbers each year led to a decrease in quality. And just 10 years after opening, the schools were forced to shut down in 1926. But as you know, this isn't where the guide dog story ends. Just as Dr. Stalling's schools were closing, another large guide dog training center had opened in Potsdam, near Berlin, and it was quickly proving its worth. Without sacrificing quality, this new school was able to train around 100 dogs at a time, with an average of 12 fully trained dogs graduating each month. Up until this point, the training of guide dogs was focused in Europe, with ready-to-serve dogs being shipped for work abroad. That is, until a wealthy American woman by the name of Dorothy Harrison Eustace heard about the work the Potsdam School was doing. Dorothy was living in Switzerland, training dogs for the army, police, and customer service, and she became intrigued by the work the school was doing, and soon made the decision to move to Potsdam for several months to learn more about their methods. Each day that Dorothy spent at the training center, she grew more and more impressed with the work being done with the dogs, inspiring her to write an article for the Saturday Evening Post in America in October 1927. After hearing about the article, a blind American named Morris Frank contacted her, sharing his interest in introducing guide dogs to the United States. Excited by the challenge, Dorothy personally trained a dog named Buddy and brought Morris over to Switzerland to learn how to work with him. After their training period was complete, Frank headed back to the United States with what is believed to be the country's first guide dog. In 1928, Dorothy's training with Frank inspired her to open her own guide dog school in Vevey, Switzerland, called the Seeing Eye. This same year, the idea of training guide dogs had spread to Italy, resulting in another guide dog school being opened there. Dorothy's Switzerland venture proved to be so successful that she opened a second school in Morristown, New Jersey, a year later in 1929. Dorothy's schools in Switzerland and New Jersey, along with the independently owned school in Italy, are recognized today as the first guide dog schools of the modern era to have survived the test of time. Through the hard work of these pioneering organizations, countless guide dog schools have been opened around the world. Today, thousands of blind and partially sighted people worldwide have had their lives changed by guide dogs, allowing them to live with dignity and independence. And for more insight into the work of guide dogs, a guest editorial by Steve Newman posted on thebark.com. The History of Seeing Eye Dogs. In New York City, on June 11, 1928, Morris Frank took one big step for the disabled and one giant leap for assistance dogs. The 20-year-old Tennessean, who lost his sight at 16, was fresh off the SS Tuscania after a month in Switzerland, where he had been trained by Dorothy Eustace to work with his first guide dog, a female German shepherd named Buddy. A group of curious, incredulous reporters greeted him at the dock, demanding to know what exactly this dog could do for him. The previous month had bolstered Frank's native southern swagger, and he boasted that Buddy could take him anywhere. Even across the West Street, they asked. Known locally as Death Avenue, it was one of the city's most hazardous thoroughfares. Frank reportedly declared, "Show me to it, brother, and Buddy will take me across it." Making good on his claim, the pair began to negotiate the wide cobblestone street against a backdrop of clopping hooves, blaring horns, screeching brakes, and the clamor of commerce. Buddy led her tall, blind master in his well-cut suit safely across to the opposite curb. This was the first time Americans had seen a guide dog in action, but certainly not the last. Frank and Eustace went on to create the Seeing Eye 6 months later, and before long, people assisted by dogs became part of daily life. Before I became a guide dog mobility instructor, I had no real idea of what guide dogs did, much less how they did it. After 11 years of training service dogs for the blind, however, I can give you some highlights of the amazing feats that dogs do every day for their people. Most of us know that dogs have a sensational sense of smell. The difference between their olfactory ability and ours is so huge that we can't really comprehend it. But to me, one of the most astonishing things about guide dogs is that they are asked to constrain this quintessential faculty. They can't wander nose to the ground, following an invisible trail this way and that, doing their jobs. Requires them to override a very powerful and innate inclination. Dogs are also adept at social intelligence. They read us really well. Guide dogs put this skill to use every moment they're on duty, responding appropriately to the variety of gestures and verbal commands a blind person uses when working with a dog, including directional cues like forward, left, and right. We expect them to obey these commands, and generally they do. But sometimes they're required to make an independent assessment of a situation and to intelligently disobey if complying would put their person in danger. For example, if there's an open manhole cover in our path, we want them to ignore the forward command. Same goes for subway platforms, tight spaces, and most importantly, traffic passing in front of us as we're about to cross the street. Guide dogs put their memories to work as well, recalling not just the place they last saw a squirrel or a cat under a bush, both of which they're trained to ignore, but also their person's bank, grocery store, and favorite coffee shop. And of course, they remember the home they share with their person. That's particularly helpful if the individual loses his or her sense of direction. So, back to 1928. Imagine your buddy. And you begin As you begin to cross, you encounter a kaleidoscope of activity. The pungent smells of rotting produce, horse manure and oil, and gas from ships and automobiles, and the constant din of horses and cars and trolleys. To the astonishment of those watching, you safely take Morris Frank through his hurly-burly to the other side of the street. It's nothing short of a miracle. Modern-day guide dogs accomplish this miracle and many more every day. But what seems phenomenal to us is run-of-the-mill for them. Fortunately, the capacities and senses with which they've been endowed can, with appropriate training, be harnessed to guide humans. It's one of the most mutually beneficial partnerships ever conceived. Next, dog and baby, introducing a pet to a newborn. This was written by Sherry Woodward, Best Friends Animal Behavioral Consultant. Getting ready for a new family member is a busy, exciting time. In addition to all that you need to do to prepare for the new baby, there are a few things you can do to make the transition easier for your pets. Most pets accept a new baby with no problem, but if you want to be extra careful, you can begin to prepare them ahead of time for the big event. The transition to life with a baby and pets can be done smoothly. What can you do to prepare your pet for the new baby? First, make sure your pets are up to date with their veterinary checkups and vaccinations. Since you may not have time for such things in the first few months after the baby's birth, give your pets plenty of special attention. Play with your cats and dogs on a regular basis. Exercise helps them to relax and it relieves stress for the whole family. If you have a dog, consider taking him or her in for training refresher course. Find a trainer who uses positive reinforcement. A trainer who has experience with babies and children is ideal since he or she can design a training, exercise, or safety plan for your family. It will save you a lot of time and frustration when you are busy with the baby if your dog knows key cues such as drop it, leave it, wait, and down or stay. Make sure you practice the cues daily with your dog. Both cats and dogs can benefit from familiarity with babies before you bring your new one home. Invite friends over who have babies and small children. Watch your animals closely to see how they react. If your pets seem unduly frightened, you might want to seek help from a behaviorist. Your veterinarian may be able to refer you to someone. Never, ever leave a baby or child unsupervised with the animals. Start using baby products such as lotion, bath soap, powder, and laundry soap. If you and the rest of the family smell like baby products, the baby will have a familiar smell when he or she arrives. Set up the baby's room as soon as possible so your animals will accept the new arrangement long before the baby comes home. A screen door can be very helpful to keep cats and dogs away from the sleeping baby. You can practice going into the room and reading aloud or talking in tones you will use with the baby. The animals will learn to wait, probably at the door, for your return. How should you introduce the baby on the big day? Mom should greet the animals while another person holds the baby, since a normal greeting from mom will help the animals feel that everything is okay. Mom can then hold out one of the baby's blankets for the animals to smell. Your dog should be held on a loose lead. When you enter the house, stay standing until the animals have had a chance to smell and listen to the baby. Ask your dog to sit or lay down before the person holding the baby sits down. Watch the animals closely. If your dog is curious, allow him to view the baby from about 6 feet away. Hold the lead loose but short enough so that the dog can't reach the baby. Reward the dog with praise if he shows no fear or aggression. If your dog has been fine with other babies, you can allow him to go closer, but use caution. What do you need to be aware of as you start life with a baby? Your animals may need reassurance that life hasn't changed all that much, so make sure you continue to give them special attention. Watch for signs of stress. Your dog may bark more, chase her tail, circle or pace, eliminate inappropriately, sulk or look depressed, start licking herself or chewing on herself incessantly, lose her appetite, or have diarrhea. Your cat may hide or seem shy, become grumpy, smacking people and other animals, eliminate inappropriately, sulk or look depressed, groom excessively to the point of making bald spots or sores, loses appetite, and have diarrhea. Any change in behavior can be a warning that your animal may need help adjusting. Consult with your veterinarian if you notice changes in your pet's behavior. When you start using a high chair to feed the baby, your cat or dog may try to share meals with the baby. Teach the animals that when the baby is eating, they don't get any tidbits. They will soon stop begging. Never give your dog a doll that looks like a real baby to play with. Young dogs that play rough need to practice being calm and gentle. You can help by giving your puppy a massage. Sit on the floor with her and slowly rub her all over until she's so relaxed she falls asleep. Try to restrict vigorous play to places the baby will not be crawling around in later, like outside or in the garage. If you need to leave your baby with a sitter, tell the sitter to keep the animals and the baby apart in your absence. Don't take unnecessary risks with any of your family members, human or otherwise. There will be new challenges when the baby starts to crawl and then to walk. You will soon have a very short person walking around the house with toys and food that may be very tempting and accessible to a dog. Once you have a toddler, it's even more important to practice your dog's cues every day. Your pets can sometimes be a big help. If your child isn't ready to calm down for a nap, try reading out loud to your dog or cat to create the appropriate restful atmosphere. Even if your animals are extremely tolerant, children need to be taught to be gentle with animals since eventually they will be around someone else's pets who may not be so tolerant. Teaching kindness and respect for animals will bring greater benefit than simply avoiding getting bitten or scratched. It builds a better world for all of us. Remember, never leave a baby or child unattended around animals. And that will do it for this week. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. I hope you enjoy the program. Thank you for listening. And remember, please spay and neuter your pets. It's healthy for them and the environment. Pets Plus Us is a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. I'm your host, Mary DeFranco. If you'd like more information about this program or to hear this program again, visit our website at wxxi.org/reachout. I'd also like to invite you to share your pet story with us by writing to us at reachout@wxxi.org.